From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Hello, I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Let's talk about old hardware, Joel. And I'm not talking about ourselves here.
My hardware is getting older and older, I must say.
Well, you know how hams love old equipment. I'm a victim of that as much as anybody else. My very first radio was a Hallicrafters S40B receiver. Now, I don't still have it, but if I did, and I do see it crop up on eBay every once in a while, I would have to restore it, and frankly, I haven't a clue, which is what we're going to talk about. Not S40Bs, but restoring old radios.
Well, that's interesting as you mentioned that particular radio, because I think, for me at least, an issue is, or an interest in particular has been radios that I wished I could afford back when I started. When I was stuck with what I could afford, which is very different. So I'd look at other people's stations and say, wow, I'd really love to have a Viking 2, which is a 1957 100-watt AM transmitter. Well, surprisingly enough, I have one in my basement. And I don't have an S40B, but I do have an S40A that I have restored. And that actually lines up with the Heathkit AT1 transmitter that I got working and have as one of my boat anchor stations.
Now, if you find the radio of your dreams at a flea market, or your past dreams, I should say.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't just take it home and plug it in, correct?
That's probably a good idea, because chances are it is not working as well as it was when it came out of the box the first time.
And yes.
That's one of the issues. And usually there are two distinct issues, and they're almost kind of two different technologies in a way. One is making it work the way it used to, which is electrical repair, basically. And the other is cosmetic restoration. So what you'll find is often that, you look under the cover, the cabinet is a little rusted on top where people have put paint cans and things over the years. The chassis is no longer shiny plated material. It's pitted, corroded material and all kinds of things. So there's two distinct things to think about. I tend to be better at the electronic repair and getting it back running than I am at the physical restoration.
Yeah, the cosmetic restoration is particularly difficult for me.
It is, and it can be can run the gamut. I mean, a lot of people work on old broadcast radios, which gets you into kind of cabinetry restoration, the same as you would with a dining room cabinet chair, that kind of wood finish thing. And because they dry out, they curl, they glue comes apart, and all those kinds of things. With metal cabinets, you end up with some issues that can be taken care of with paint, but the problem is usually the lettering and so forth is a very difficult thing to do for the person that doesn't do it all the time.
That's almost an art,
absolutely,
putting the lettering back on.
So it's really two different kinds of techniques. But in terms of the electrical repair to make the radio play well, and if it plays well, the person at the other end of the QSO doesn't know what it looks like. It knows what it sounds like.
And doesn't care.
And if you take a picture of it, put a little fuzzy filter in front of it, or
a vignette.
Yes, exactly. Do something that takes the detail out of it. And my equipment kind of looks that way, my old equipment. I have a number of elderly stations of different decades, and some work better than others, and some look better than others. But most of them work most of the time.
So now, let's just say I find that S40B somewhere. Do I need to plug it into, help me out, Joel, what is it called? An auto transformer, variable?
A Variac, you're thinking.
Variac, yes.
Some people recommend that, and what that does is that subjects it to lower voltages, and you can kind of crank up the voltage slowly.
And wait for things to go bang.
And wait for things to go bang, or smoke to be released from the components. And that's kind of a controversial subject, because for one thing, the typical older, and here we're talking, I guess I'm thinking in my mind, vacuum tube era equipment.
Now,
there's good material from the 70s that are solid state.
That is considered vintage now.
That is also
vintage.
Right. So that's kind of a different thing. Now, the first thing you have to remember is, for those of us who mainly have been working with common current solid state equipment, most voltages are 15 volts and below. Mm-hmm. And you have no particular dramatic issues of putting your hands in there, although you can do some creative arc welding on your wedding ring or your watch band. I've done that. especially with high current supplies. But it's very important to worry about electrical safety, because even your S40B probably had 400 volts on the plates of the audio tubes.
I'm sure, yeah.
And if you put your fingers in there, it's going to be a lot different than 15 volts. And in fact, you can kill yourself. So,
oh yeah.
So it's very important to make sure that you know what you're doing, and that when you have your fingers in there, you have the power off and you have the power supply capacitors discharged, so there's no voltage lurking there.
Yes.
So that's one thing. The other thing I suggest, if you look at the recent article I had about the Heathkit AT1 transmitter, I had a little section about electrical safety and the differences that in the way people powered equipment in that time. And that's worth reading, because much of the equipment that you'll deal with has the same kinds of issues, which is not having a three-prong plug on the power, not having the cabinet grounded to the electrical ground, and therefore the likelihood that leakage will result in 120 volts on the cabinet.
Yes.
You pick the radio up on your workbench, and all of a sudden you're dropping it again.
Oh,
that's,
yeah.
That's not good for you or the radio, I've found. I've done that even recently, and I should know better. But so, you know, one thing you could do as a very first step is replace the power cord with a three-wire cord with a grounded plug. Put the ground wire directly to the chassis. Another thing that most radios of that era did not have was a fuse. Fuses are good.
Mm-hmm.
So you take the black wire of the three-wire cable, which is the hot side, and put a fuse in that suitable for the current that the radio is going to draw. And you can make it twice as big so the starting current won't cause it to blow. But that gives you some protection from real disasters that could happen with that radio that they didn't think about in the 50s and 40s.
True.
And so that's one thing.
Then I could plug it in.
Then you could plug it in. Well, yes. I don't know. I still... one thing you can do, one thing I suggest you do is carefully remove all the tubes, including the rectifier tube, and then plug it in and turn it on, and carefully measure the AC voltage from the transformer getting to the rectifier and make sure that it's right and the transformer is working well. And then work your way into the radio one piece at a time. The problem with the Variac approach is if you plug in a rectifier tube, it wants to work with typically 5 volts on the filament. Well, if you cut the AC input down to 50 volts, it'll have 2.5 volts on there, 2 volts on the filament. And it won't work very well.
No.
But, that's an approach that some people take. Another thing you can do is temporarily insert a pair of silicon diodes appropriate for the voltage rating in place of the rectifier tube that don't have the filaments to worry about, and then slowly increase the voltage with just that in the circuit. And what that will do is will allow you to determine if the filter capacitors and the power supply are working properly. And you can bring it up slowly, and sometimes over a number of days if it hasn't been on for a long time. That'll help. Alternately, what you can do is test the capacitors separately.
Well, now that's a question that I often hear asked about old radios. In particular, now when I'm saying old, I'm talking 50, 60-year-old radios.
Right.
Do you have to replace every electrolytic capacitor, just as a matter of course?
Not really. Particularly, I found the oil-filled capacitors tend to not fail as much as the wax paper type or the other kinds of old capacitors. But you can test them. If they're good and they have no particular leakage, and sometimes old capacitor testers of the same era have a voltage testing arrangement, you can actually apply a voltage and see what happens. And if they're good, you know, chances are they'll be good for another who knows how many years. But it's fairly likely that you'll find capacitors that have failed. And there's an argument that says replace them. And that's certainly fairly conservative. The problem is the typical form factor of the old capacitors was a tin can that mounted through the chassis. You may be able to find some of those sort of new that have never been used, but they're probably almost as old, so the chances are that they've also failed on the shelf. So that means you replace them with something that doesn't look like. You know, is that a big problem? It depends on how worried you are about maintaining the historical integrity. So that's kind of a trade-off. But
yes,
certainly in terms of making it work, you're probably well advised to replace the power supply capacitors. And really, any capacitors in the radio that are of the wax paper type or the so-called black beauty types, the capacitors, they almost always fail or get leaky. The mica capacitor is less likely to be a problem.
Well, as long as we're talking about passive components, what about the resistors? Can I trust those not to have changed their value very much?
Well, they have done that too. I mean, they probably have changed their value. And that raises another question. I mean, I guess one of the things you do, depending on how you want to approach this, if you want to take a chance on the components that are in there, power it up with your hand on the plug so you can pull it out very quickly. And see what happens. And then if you have a manual with the radio, chances are it gives you the voltage on every pin of every tube socket. And if you go around and check those voltages, that gives you a good idea of what's happening. And it should be fairly close to what the book suggests, except that the radio probably was designed for 110 volts AC, and you've plugged it into 120 volts probably.
Yes.
So it's going to be, what's that, 9% higher. So
that's true.
Chances are things will be a little higher, which also puts a little more stress on components than they were designed for. Usually that's not an issue, but it's just something to be aware of. And what you may find is a lot of times if one of those wax paper capacitors was used as a screen bypass, for example, in an audio stage, if it's shorted out, what will happen is the screen grid resistor will be driving much higher current, or the lower resistance, much higher current than it was intended to, and it will turn into a capacitor because the capacitor turned into a resistor. It's kind of a
little joke.
So you'll find those by doing voltage checks, and they're generally done with the tubes and the sockets, which is not bad. Also, you know, if you have a tube checker, check all the tubes.
Well, I have a question about that. Before I get to it, though, let's take a 60-second break and hear from our sponsor, DX Engineering.
Remember your first contact? The excitement of that first CQ? The exhilaration of making your first QSO? At DX Engineering, we know that feeling too. That's why we've committed to making your on-air experience the very best it can be. DX Engineering ships quickly, which means less station downtime. And we have free shipping for almost any order over $99. We've recently expanded our inventory, so you don't have to wait for the gear you need. DX Engineering has introduced all new radio products and revived legendary brands, all with the goal of helping you enjoy amateur radio. Most importantly, the DX Engineering team is here to help you. You've got a team of highly experienced hams ready to work out technical issues, answer questions, and help you optimize your station performance. That excitement you felt from the first contact, it can happen again and again with help from DX Engineering. DXEngineering.com. That's DXEngineering.com.
All right, we're back, Joel, and I promised a question, and that has to do with those vacuum tubes.
You
mentioned the tube checker. What about the tubes? Can I trust those? Have they gone soft after all these years?
They tend to head in that direction. I mean, tubes don't get better with time. There's no question about that. In my experience, many times they work. But a lot of times what's happened is there's, even though the vacuum sealed glass envelope tends to keep the air out and the vacuum in, there's always a little bit of migration. And what happens is some of that comes back in the tube. Now, most tubes have a device called a getter, which will tend to eliminate that. So a lot of times, once you've decided nothing's going to blow up, it's not a bad idea to let the radio sit with the power on, with a smoke detector nearby, and and let it run for overnight or a day or two, and that'll help bring the tubes back. So that's a good...
Well, I never thought about that. That's a good idea.
And, you know, in my experience, I've got radios from World War II that still work with original tubes.
With the original tubes.
Absolutely right.
I mean, where do you find tubes these days,
anyway? That's an interesting question because, surprisingly enough, tubes are readily available. And you can buy tubes from a number of sources. I guess one I've had good luck with over the years is Antique Electronic Supply, whose website is tubesandmore.com. And you'll find in there new old stock tubes and original boxes of almost every type of tube. Now, a few are quite expensive because they've been taken over by the audiophile tube people, like Type 45s, for example, which were an audio power tube, also popular in early transmitters, are very expensive. But most receiving tubes cost very much about the same dollar amount as they used to in 1950.
Thinking of transmitting tubes, I mean, what about the venerable 6146? Can you still get that?
Yes, you can. You can get almost anything. Transmitting tubes tend to be somewhat more pricey. There were fewer of them. But if you think about it, in the 50s, every TV repair shop had shelves and caddies full of tubes. They're still around, and somebody bought them and so forth, and they get turned around. And, you know, you can buy a tube in the box, brand new, never been used, sitting there since 1953. For, you know, $1.75, $2.50, whatever it is, with some exceptions. Some are hard to find, but most general-purpose tubes, of which there were vast quantities made, are still available. You know, you can look for them on, you can search on for them using an internet search tool and find other people that have them. It's surprising in a way. Tubes are made for a long time, and in fact, at the end of the tube era, the government subsidized the manufacture of many types of tubes to maintain equipment that was in places where it was hard to put in new equipment. So, you know, your DO-line radars and things like that. they didn't immediately switch to solid state. They subsidized tubes being made so they could support that equipment. So that kept a lot of production lines going even beyond the time when you think they should have.
But now that you can't just walk into an electronics store, if you can even find an electronics store, and test a vacuum tube anymore, how do you test a tube if you maybe suspect that it's gone by the wayside?
That's more of a problem than it used to be.
Yes.
But there are two solutions. One is go to a ham fest and buy a tube checker.
I see those every once in a while.
And you know, people are not selling them for a lot because it's a relatively small fraction of the community that's interested in doing this seriously. I have one in my basement that I bought many years ago. Sometimes works. But the other choice you have, which may be cheaper if you don't do this all the time, is say, you know, you have a radio with 3 6AU6s in it. Well, go to your website and for $5, buy 2 new 6AU6s and substitute, keeping track of which one is which, and try them in different positions in the radio. And you may be able to tell by using a known good, hopefully, new tube whether the one that was in there was bad. Of course, the filaments are usually pretty obvious if they're
right.
Illuminated. And usually if the filament is working, chances are it'll do something. It may not be up to the maximum gain, but it'll operate. And, you know, once you get close to getting it working well, then you can say, well, let me see if a different 6AU6 in the RF amplifier will work better. So that's another possibility.
Restoring solid-state transceivers or receivers, I would think, based on what we've discussed, would have to be a heck of a lot easier. Or not.
Well, I think not, just because I grew up in the vacuum tube era, maybe. But here's the problem with solid-state stuff. You look in the under the covers of a solid-state radio. Instead of seeing it, let's take a vacuum tube radio first. You look in the bottom of the chassis, you see vacuum tube pins, you see terminal strips, you see components wired between them. You can get to them with your meter. You can know which which. You open up a solid-state piece of solid-state equipment, you see a coated printed circuit board that may even have multiple layers, so you can't even necessarily get to all of the wiring in it to measure things.
Right.
And to get a component out of, I don't know if you've ever replaced a 28-pin integrated circuit.
Yes.
But to unsolder 28 pins and have
a painful exercise.
It is a painful exercise. Now, it's not to say it can't be done. It's worth doing, but, you know, frankly, unless it's something around the edges of the PC board or some controls or something that I can get to, I usually leave that to people who have more patience than I do. So I'm happy to deal with anything I can put my soldering gun into, I'm happy with. But but you just can't do that with a PC board-based radio unless you're willing to deal with the consequences of possibly destroying the board or whatever, because it's hard to get things in and out.
You know, and the solid-state radios may have solid-state displays that are unobtainium, as they say these days.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's a big issue with many radios. I mean, the manufacturers, you know, stop supporting equipment when they can no longer get the parts, and I don't blame them. But
right.
Somebody would say, well, had they been really clever, they would have stocked up on a lot of spares, but maybe they've run out of them too.
And some manufacturers do keep spares for quite a long time. I used to be employed years ago by the R.L. Drake Company.
Ah, yes.
They kept spares for a number of years after I was there, and in fact, they may still carry spare parts for the old Drake receivers, transceivers, and transmitters.
Well, that's interesting. I actually have one of my old stations is a Drake setup that works very nicely. Yes, that raises a good point. And not only the manufacturers could do that, but another thing is that if your manufacturer says to you, you send them a letter and say, my radio has gone casters up, can you fix it? And they say, I'm sorry, we don't support that anymore. There are independent contractors who do repair work and specialize in each of the different radio brands.
Yes.
And if you're a little searching, you may find one. And they, cleverly enough, saw this coming and stocked up on the parts.
That's
even
right.
If the manufacturers didn't. So when the radios were new, they bought the parts that were then available. And if you're lucky and the part that failed in your radio is one that they have, they may be able to fix it for you.
And they have all the literature, too. I sent a transceiver off to a fellow I won't indulge in advertising here in the podcast, but a gentleman here in the Northeast, and he did a superb job repairing my transceiver at the time. That was just a few years ago.
Yeah, there are the number that I don't know the names offhand, but there are always more than one option. I have some rules about restoring old radios that I think are worth mentioning. My rule number one is assume, unless you know something specifically otherwise, assume that the radio was working until it stopped.
Mm-hmm.
Many people say, oh, the radio's not working. I wonder if I should tweak the IF transformers, see if that'll bring it back. It probably won't. So my rule is assume it was working until it stopped. Find out what made it stop. Repair that. and bring it back. Once you have it back, then you're prepared to deal with an alignment and so forth. But and if it doesn't come back right away, you know, deal with it systematically. Inject the signal in the audio stages and see if it comes out the speaker. If that does, then you move it to the IF stages and put a signal in there and make see if it comes out and so forth. And as you move towards the antenna, each time you go, if you're on the right frequency, the signal should get louder. If it doesn't, the stage you just moved to the front of has got a problem. So you can kind of check it out that way. You could actually start from either end, but that's probably the easiest way because you use a signal generator, and there you go.
All right, Joel, it's question time. We have one here from Scott, W9WSW, and he asks, my earliest exposure to HF radio was listening to my grandfather's Zenith transoceanic shortwave receiver. He strung a long wire antenna from the window of his study to a tree and connected it to the radio with an alligator clip. In that regard, how important is it to have a resonant antenna for a specific band when you're simply listening?
That's a good question, and a lot of people wonder about what the limitations are of that. And it comes down to a fairly straightforward thing. Such an antenna is not optimum. The lack of optimality is a function of how much difference it makes. On the lower frequency bands, typically the receiver performance is limited by atmospheric noise, which means if you have an inefficient antenna that gives you a weak signal, that same antenna will give you weak external noise on that frequency. Mm-hmm. And if that noise is louder than the noise made inside the receiver, which every receiver does, the fact that it's not optimum will just mean you'll have to turn the volume control up a little bit. The signal-to-noise ratio will be limited by what the antenna picks up. Now, that typically for most radios is true on the bands up through perhaps 10 megahertz. Above that frequency, the radio is often limited by the internal noise in the receiver. Now, if you have an inefficient antenna, the signal that you get from the antenna will be lower intensity than noise in the receiver, and you'll have trouble receiving it. So that it depends on performance of the receiver compared to the atmospheric noise. You can sort of tell this if you put the antenna on and the signal the noise level goes up significantly, chances are you're limited by antenna noise. And then the antenna exactly won't, the exact nature of the antenna won't make that much difference. Now, of course, with any antenna, it'll receive better from some directions than others, and that's something that's easier to compute, perhaps, for a resonant antenna than for a random wire in a tree. So you may find you receive South American signals fine, but not European signals or vice versa. And that would be a function of the characteristics of that particular antenna.
Well, that makes sense. Hey, before we close, I wanted to mention that for our listeners, most of our listeners, by the time they hear this podcast, it'll be December 29th or it could be New Year's Eve itself. And I just wanted to thank everybody for being loyal listeners. Ever since we started on April the 7th, we've been averaging on the order of 11 to 12,000 individual unique listeners per episode. And I just want to say thank you to each and every one of you and best wishes for a happy new year.
I echo that completely and point out that I guess it's not inappropriate to say that we've been sponsored through 2017. So we'll be here for a while more.
Yes, we definitely will. Thank you, Joel.
Thank you, and Happy New Year to all.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.